Early last year, a woman named Boa Sr. died. She was 85 years old and lived on the Andaman Islands off the coast of Myanmar in the Indian Ocean. The story of her death was covered by news outlets around the world, some of which posted a recording of Boa Sr. singing an ancestral song in her native language. I'd like to translate the lyrics for you, but I can't. They are in the Boa language, which had been the late Boa Sr.'s mother tongue. The Boa language died with her, and with her passing was also lost the culture, the history, the logic of the very small civilization in which it once flourished. The question is, so what? And that is the question that former OTM producer Mike Volo pursues with Bob in this second installment of their occasional series called Lexicon Valley.
Monday morning, flipping through the newspaper, there on page D34, an obituary for the Native American language Ojibwe. How do you feel?
How do I feel? I feel like Ojibwe. Hey, you got the sports section? Give me the sports section.
Oh, come on. Not even you're that callous.
Okay. How do I feel? I feel as if I'm supposed to be sad. Although, if push comes to shove, I'm not sure I could exactly tell you why.
Fair enough. Let me try to give you some perspective. There are somewhere between 6,000 and 7,000 languages currently being spoken on Earth. The most conservative estimates are that about half of those will be extinct in the next century. And the most dire estimates are that 90% of them will be extinct, and it won't even take a century. We're not talking, of course, about English or French or Italian or Chinese or Russian, the 80 to 100 biggest languages in the world. They're spoken by about 4.5 billion people. We're talking about languages that, by and large, you've never heard of, the 3,500 or so smallest languages in the world. They're spoken by less than 10 million people. Those are the languages that are going to be going extinct.
Well, one way to look at it seems to me, and maybe the most hard-hearted, is if a language dies in the Andaman rainforest and nobody is alive to notice it or need it or use it or remember it, does it matter?
Well, my goal is to get you to believe that maybe it does matter. I had a conversation recently with David Harrison. He's a co-founder of the Living Tongue Institute for Endangered Languages, and he travels all over the world talking to so-called last speakers. He told me that there are three kind of categories of human knowledge that we stand to lose when we lose these languages.
First and foremost, it's about human history, mythology, the stories, the beliefs, the ways that people have interpreted their existence.
Let's call this first category cultural knowledge. There are people all over the world who have in their native language the equivalent of, say, you know, Homer's Odyssey, Beowulf maybe, and they've never been documented. One of Harrison's linguistic areas of expertise is the native languages of Siberia, and he has spent a lot of time among a people there who speak a language called Tuvan. And on one trip, an elder recited for him an 8,000-line poem from memory that Harrison told me was about a young girl whose brother dies in a hunting accident.
And she sets off on a magical quest accompanied by her talking horse, and she has to fulfill various feats of strength and win the hand of a princess who is then going to bring her dead brother back to life.
Mike, I know you're going to think I'm a Philistine, but we lose the Tuvan Mr. Ed story. Does the Earth still spin on its axis?
Think of it this way. About 200 or so of the world's languages are written. The rest, including Tuvan, are only spoken. So I think that Harrison feels this sense of urgency. If we lose these myths and creation stories, then we lose sort of pieces of the puzzle of humanity.
An insight into understanding humanity itself.
Exactly.
Okay, so that takes care of culture.
Second category, we'll call it scientific knowledge. I remember very distinctly in like fifth grade, another kid telling me that Eskimos had a gazillion words for snow. That isn't quite true. But turns out, says Harrison, that the Inuit people of North America have almost 100 words for sea ice. So who cares? What does that mean?
Maybe they're just going with the flow.
I think what Harrison would say is that having 100 variations on the theme denotes a really sophisticated knowledge of that theme, knowledge that is not transferable to other languages. Another example that Harrison used was from Siberia, a language called Tofa.
So if you use a word like chare in the Tofa language, chare means four-year-old male, domesticated, uncastrated, rideable reindeer. That's a concept that I can express in English, but notice that English does not give us the efficiency of a single word that means all of those things. And so you have to view this as a kind of technology.
What you know about your environment plays an important role in how you name and sort that environment. So we here in the West have a tradition of taxonomy that's based on the fossil record, based on our ability to retrace the branches of evolution. Other people elsewhere in the world have their own taxonomies and their own way of sorting their environment based on what they know.
Just give me an example, please.
For example, there is a people in Brazil who speak a language called Kayapo, and they divide up the bees in their region into 50-some-odd what we would call species. And I just want to read to you the criteria by which they divide up these insects. Flight patterns, aggressive behavior, sound, habitat, geometry of nest structure, shape, color, markings, smell of the bee. There's some guy running around with a really swollen nose. Quality and quantity of honey, edibility of larvae, quality of wax, and more. These people know a hell of a lot about bees, and what they know isn't necessarily built into our taxonomy.
Okay, that covers culture and science. What's the third leg of Harrison's language preservation stool?
Straight linguistics. For example, in English, typical word order for sentences is subject, verb, object.
I climbed a tree.
Yeah, subject, verb, object.
I mean, I haven't climbed a tree in years.
Now, there are other languages.
That was just an example.
Gotcha. Now, there is a word order that is the exact reverse of English, object, verb, subject, that is extremely rare.
Tree climbed I?
A tree climbed I, exactly. Now, you might say that in English if you were being poetic or rhetorical, but it's not sort of standard English word order. But it is standard in a language called Yururina, spoken by a native people who live in what is now Peru. Now, there are countless examples of languages that do sort of quirky things that we would never have guessed languages would do.
So what? What's the benefit to humanity to find out what the rest of humanity is up to linguistically?
Essentially, what you're asking me, Bob, is what is the point of knowing any information unless you can use it to some end? You know, we can shred up whole categories of academia, history for that matter.
Ooh, snap. Okay, look, I'm just going to put you down for enlightenment is good for humanity.
Well, you know, now that I think about it, my motivation for caring about these dying languages might not be so pure. Because, you know, when you're a kid and you're debating about which superpower you want, I always said to people that I wanted to be able to speak every language on Earth, which usually met one of two reactions. Lame. Or that's not a real superpower. And if in 200 years there are only two or three languages left, then it really won't be a superpower.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Let's do this again another time.
That was Bob with former OTM producer Mike Forlow.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Emily Chin and Joe Rosenberg, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Granis.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at zbiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's zbiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.